In this episode, episode 46 of the Daily Hustle Show, it is part three about what makes word of mouth contagious so that you and your business can use word of mouth to continue growing. And also, our daily wins of the week is right in Marshall's wheelhouse.
Broadcasting from the box that rocks and Thrive15.com world headquarters, it's the Daily Hustle with Daniel McKenna.
Folks, welcome into episode 46 of the Daily Hustle. This is part three of making word of mouth contagious, why things catch on. Over to my left, Marshall F. Morris. Over here, Daniel McKenna. And this is the third and final part in this series, again, for all the small business owners and entrepreneurs out there who count on word of mouth to drive their business. We're talking about the factors of why things catch on and why you can get other people to continue talking about your stuff. Marshall, how are you doing over there today?
I'm doing spectacular. Dare I say sensational?
Do you dare to say that?
I dare.
You do dare to say sensational?
I do.
That's very risky of you.
Yeah, I like to live on the edge.
Living on the edge. This is episode 46, which of course, obviously, is the Bo Outlaw episode.
Really?
Obviously, yeah. Bo Outlaw was the king of the summer league.
Educate me.
Played in the league for a long time.
Which league?
The NBA.
Oh, okay.
The National Basketball Association.
Okay.
I believe it was like 12 or 13 years. But he was the kind of guy that was never like an all-star. And so since he wasn't an all-star, even though he'd been playing in the league, they kept having him play in the summer league too. You know, those guys have him play in the summer league too, along with the rookies and stuff. And he would just dominate the summer league.
Okay.
And then he was just okay during the regular season. Just a solid guy.
Okay.
In fact, if you search for him, number one, there's two things that'll pop out. On multiple different websites, if you search for Bo Outlaw. Number one, that he was a terrific athlete, tough defender, only shot 52% from the free throw line.
Not great.
Not great. Not great. Secondly, his most famous moment in his basketball career, allegedly, came in 1998. He scored 25 points, 13 rebounds, 10 assists. And a reporter asked him how he felt about his triple-double, and which led to his famous reply, "What's that? Some kind of hamburger."
Well,
that's what he's known for.
When you don't get it regularly,
it's hard to know. How would Bo Outlaw know?
There's no way.
He's the king of the summer league, and this episode is dedicated to him, Bo Outlaw.
That's awesome.
All right, Bo Outlaw, this one's for you. Six principles of contagiousness. We've already talked about social currency, triggers, emotion, and public. We're finishing off with the last two here, practical value and stories. Marshall, let's go ahead and dive right in. Give us the summary of practical value.
Again, this is from Jonah Berger's book, Contagious, okay, talking about STEPS as an acronym of why things catch on, why things get talked about. Practical value, again, the recap is it's all about crafting content that seems useful, okay? It provides functional, practical value. People like to help others, so if we can show them how our products or ideas will save time, improve health, save money, they'll spread the word, okay? So we have to create content that is valuable information for those that we want to read it.
That's right.
That's the overview.
That's the overview. Okay. So stuff that saves time, saves money, improves health is the sort of stuff that it's practical for me to know this, but which means it's practical for you to know this, which means I might tell other people about it. Let's talk a little bit about the psychology of the deal here, Marshall.
Okay.
We saw that in here, saving time and saving money were two of the three things that they said, this is why this stuff gets shared, right? So let's talk about deals, saving money. Scenario A. Let's say you're looking to buy a new grill.
Okay.
You're out there, you're looking for a new grill. You know, you're going to do some barbecuing this weekend. Maybe a steak or something. You find a grill that you like. It's been marked down from $350 to $250. Huge sale.
$100 off.
Do you buy it or do you keep looking? You found a grill you like and it's $100 off.
I'm probably still searching.
You're probably still searching?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, 75% of the people who received scenario A said they would go ahead and buy the grill.
Oh, really?
It was the one they were looking for. It was $100 off. It's like, bam, got it. Getting that grill. Here's scenario B. Imagine you're at the store. You find the grill you like. And it's marked down from $255 to $240. Do you buy it or do you keep looking?
Big discount, but it's the grill you want. It's $15 off.
$15 off.
Yeah.
It's only $240.
It's only $240.
I'll think about it.
Think about it. Well, in this scenario, only 22% of the people said they would buy the Grill B. But Grill B was cheaper, Marshall. How does that make sense? How does that work?
I don't know.
Well, Daniel Kahneman, I know I'm pronouncing his name incorrectly. Maybe it's Kahneman, maybe it's Connie Mann. He won a Nobel Prize in economics for his study on the prospect theory. Now, why does this matter to you? Well, we're going to tell you how this works in the human's mind so that you know how to craft your content. It says that judgments and decisions are not always rational and optimal. That's weird. Sounds like something we've talked about here on the show before. Instead, they are based on psychological principles of how people perceive and process information. And people don't evaluate things in absolute terms, Marshall. They evaluate them relative to a comparison standard or a reference point. Maybe you've heard of price anchoring. Whether that seems like a fair price or not depends on your expectations. So, Marshall, why in scenario B, even though you were scenario C, you were like, man, I'm going to keep looking regardless of what you tell me. Yeah, that was you. You were scenario C. You're like,
I didn't have anything to grill.
No grill is good enough for me. I'm going to continue looking until they invent a new grill.
That's right.
I want my grill to also come like as a motor vehicle. I can drive my grill around town. That way I can have steak however I want it, whenever I want it.
Yeah, I'm getting it grilled at the grocery store.
That's right. While you're shopping for your other stuff, it's grilling outside. So the 75% of the people have said A, sounded good, and B, 22% said it sounded good. Why is that? What are they talking about here?
It's relative to what the original anchor price point is. Because they feel like they're reaching a better deal, there's more value created around the grill, and you're getting it at a better price, we don't have the ability to look at the end dollar amount. We can only look at what it was going to cost, and then because of the discount, what it costs now. And so therefore, there's a greater value created.
Whether that seems like a fair price or not depends on your expectations. So unless you know the price of the grill, you know beforehand, this is a $250 grill. And you go out and you start looking, and you're like, this one's $100 off. Holy moly. This grill's $100 off. That's incredible.
I say holy moly a lot.
Holy moly? Whereas if you don't know the price and you look at a $15 discount, you're like, yeah, 15 bucks. I'm going to keep looking. You can probably find another grill pretty similar to it, maybe a little cheaper. Maybe that's a little more function.
Maybe.
So let's keep talking about this. Marketing scientists to test their theory, which I did not know there was such a thing as marketing scientists, but there are. To test their theory, created two different versions of a catalog and mailed each to more than 50,000 people. A lot of catalogs. In one version, some of the products were marked with signs that said preseason sale. In the other versions, the items were not marked as on sale. Same items, two different catalogs. The catalog with the sale sold 50% more stuff. The kicker, the final price of the stuff in both versions of the catalog were the same.
That's the hot sauce.
So in one catalog, it said, huge sale, down to $10. And the other catalog said, this is $10.
Just that loud, too.
That loud.
With an exclamation point.
And the stuff that said it was on sale had a 50%, it sold 50% more.
Okay.
So what does that mean for you? Well, if that means for you, if you are in a business that does not sell a commodity, meaning everybody has the same sort of thing.
Gas.
Like gas. Everybody, you can go and get the same, the Quick Trip gas. I like Quick Trip more than Shell and more than Texaco, but I'm assuming it's the same sort of gas that's going in my vehicle.
Quick Trip gas tastes better than Shell gas.
Is that verifiable?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's fact check.
Well, if you're not in it for the taste, gas is all the same, right?
Like
that's right. It's like if it's cheaper right next door, then I'm going to go there because it's cheaper.
Yeah.
It's the same stuff.
Yeah.
And as long as you're not selling a commodity, meaning everybody knows the same price relatively, everybody knows the cheapest price wins because it's the same stuff. As long as you're not selling a commodity, you can use this type of thinking when you're pricing your products.
Especially if it's a service.
Thank you. Thank you for chiming in there.
Everybody loves a deal. Okay.
Go on.
Everybody loves a deal. Everybody loves to feel special, including there's this weird, this weird phenomenon that I wouldn't say it happens to everybody because everybody loves a deal, but I'm gonna use my mom as an example with the full information, knowing that she might watch this episode.
Hi, Mrs. Morris.
She'll come home. Maybe somebody can relate to this. Comes home, honey. Guess what? I saved $200 today.
Yeah. Uh huh.
$200. You'd be so proud of me. $200.
How did you save $200?
Well, you know, I got all this stuff and I saved $200. Oh, really? Well, how much did you spend to save that $200? Oh, I spent $700. What?
But it would have been $900.
But it would have been $900. And so we play this game where it's the money-saving game.
Yeah.
The person that can save the most money wins.
Sure. It's a deal.
It's basically the principle that the entire concept of Black Friday was built upon.
Sure.
Black Friday, it's a deal. Come buy stuff.
Well, and if you don't know, if you have not used, let's say you sell a product. If you have not used your specific product, I probably don't know how you match up against the competitor's product. And what the price is how I'm going to also determine how valuable that product is, right?
Yeah.
If there's a $200 silver llama and a $300 silver llama, instinctively, I'm going to think that either A, maybe this is slightly overpriced, but B, that's probably a better silver llama.
Yeah. You're selling your silver llamas at like $20.
Yeah.
I'm selling mine at $900,000 and discounting it $800,000.
Well, A, that's a huge discount.
That's a huge discount. You save a lot of money.
I would buy that silver llama regardless.
Yeah.
That's a huge discount.
That's a big discount.
But typically, the things that are priced more, if you have not actually used the products, you assume that they are better. You assume it's more quality.
Based only on price.
Based only on price. The infomercial example. Not only do I get it for not only $700, nope, not $400, not $300, $19.99. In fact, I'm going to throw in two and you get a knife sharpener. What? That's a crazy deal. I would be crazy not to get this hose that fills up by itself or something.
Already have a knife.
That knife cuts through the boot.
I have a knife sharpener already. I don't need a knife sharpener.
Whether that seems like a fair price or not depends on your expectations. Same thing for your customer. There is such a thing called diminishing sensitivity. Diminishing sensitivity, which is basically saying if there's a clock radio, it's $35. The same one, they've got in another store 10 minutes away. You find out 10 minutes away, there's another one. It's only $20. Wow. It's almost half price off. It's almost half price. Run down the Target real quick. Yeah, it's an extra 10 minutes. I'm going to save $15. This is a sweet deal. You might make the extra trip to do that. But diminishing sensitivity talks about the same thing. Let's say that there's you're buying a TV for $1,020.
$1,020?
$1,020.
Okay, $1,020.
$1,020. Right down the road, that TV is only $1,000. $20 off.
It's cheaper.
It's only a 10-minute drive.
You know, 10-minute drive, $20, all right.
Yeah, but you're already spending $1,020, so you're like, meh.
Nah.
Nah, whatever. Not really a big deal. So it's the same $20 you're saving either way, but it seems like it's not that big of a deal anymore because of the level of like what you're spending. So there's diminishing sensitivity in there. And the rule of 100, this is what marketers have figured out, the rule of 100. Marshall, go ahead and read us the rule of 100. Give us the rule of 100 here.
Lower price products like books or groceries, price reductions seem more significant when they're framed in percentage terms. Higher price products in dollar terms seem like a better deal. So if a product's price is less than $100, the rule of 100 says that percentage discounts will seem larger. So 20% off of a $30 shirt seems bigger than $6 off a $30 shirt.
So how do you perceive that this thing is discounted more heavily? Well, if it's under $100, use percentage.
Yep.
Because then you can say, this is 30% off. Well, 30% off like a $10 item is now like a $7 item.
That's right.
30% off seems like a much bigger deal than saying this $10 item is $3 off. But if you flip it the other way around, let's say you're talking about like $1,000 off. Now saying this $1,000 item is 10% off. Doesn't seem like that big of a deal.
No, it's not that.
But if you say it's $100 off, that kind of seems like a big deal.
I could do a lot with $100.
That's a lot of dollar tacos for you.
That's $100 tacos.
So that's a rule of 100. Rule of 100. Keep that in mind when you are framing your content. The rule of 100. Let's talk about the other side. Useful information. Useful information here, Marshall. We talked about the psychology of deals. Let's talk about useful information. What is useful information? What are we talking about?
So it's helping people do things that they want to do and encouraging them to do things that they want to do or encouraging to do things they should do either faster, better, or easier.
So it's like, hey, this is something you'd be interested in, or hey, this is something you need to do.
Yeah. You should start working out. In fact, here are 8 different exercises that you can do in your home. That's useful information.
In fact, health and education articles are among the highest ones shared. Why is that? Well, they're saying either A, you probably need to get more healthy, or B, you probably need to learn something. Probably need to get edumacated.
Edumacated?
Probably need to get I'm going to send this email over to Marshall, get him edumacated. Starts working out real good.
Or you might need to know the 8 different ways to use a paperclip.
Yeah, you started in that last episode. You started talking about it.
Oh, yeah, I was teasing it.
You're teasing it. Do you have the rest of it now? Or
No.
Oh, okay. Teasing it for a future episode.
Yeah, future episode.
The long tease.
Yeah, the long tease.
Okay.
It's the long play.
Health and education articles are among the highest ones shared. Recipes and reviews of up-and-coming restaurants are also highly shared because these things are seen as useful, Marshall. So how can you at home get your content to seem useful? How can you get your content, whether it's your product, your service, your latest blog, your latest coupon, whatever it is, how can you make that seem useful to get it shared? Well, number one, you can package information in short lists focused around a key topic. Just like Marshall was saying, the kind of articles that get shared a lot are stuff like 10 dating tips for the new year, 5 ways to lose weight,
8 ways to use this paperclip.
That's a very highly shared article.
That's right.
That we're going to continue talking about. Now, something to keep in mind, also, besides the way you actually package that information to get that shared, is who is the audience? You would assume that there's a bigger audience for the sport of football than there is for the sport of water polo. And you'd be right. A lot more people are interested in football than in water polo. But just because more people can share doesn't mean they will. Marshall, what are we talking about here?
So this is talking about the more specific the niche, the more narrow the content, the more relevant, the more specific that I feel it will hit what I'm wanting to learn about. Okay. So I might not want to learn about football, but I might want to learn about the Cleveland Browns football.
Right.
Okay. Or I might not want to learn about the Cleveland Browns football, but the Cleveland Browns offense. Okay. So it gets super niche. Okay. Maybe it's not just food, but maybe it's recipes, or maybe it's gluten-free recipes. So the more specific the content, the more likely it is believed to have an impact, to be more useful.
So from the book Contagious, narrower content may actually be more likely to be shared because it reminds people of a specific friend or family member and makes them feel compelled to pass it along. So for instance, if I just saw some article about why the Browns were the worst team in NFL history, I might pass that on to Marshall. I might.
I'm not amused.
Well, regardless, let's say the article is saying how the Cleveland Browns are going to be the best team in NFL history next year.
That's right.
Next year's a resurgence year.
Next year's our year.
I'd probably think of Marshall.
That's
right. It's more narrow in content. I'd probably be much more likely to share that content with Marshall than I would be about a study about people watching football.
That's right.
So how do you get your content to be shared? Well, you package it in short lists focused on a key topic, and the narrower you get, actually the better it becomes if that's your target audience. If your target audience wants to know about that little niche thing, the more likely it is to penetrate their wall of not caring. And if it penetrates that and they care and they're like, oh, Sam could use this. Marshall could use this. Bill, did you see this, Bill? Bill, did you see this? You got to see this, Bill.
You got to see it.
So if you know your target market and you know specifically what matters to them, package that information in a short list, focus on a key topic, get that out to them. It's going to be much more likely to be shared.
Fact.
Okay. So lastly, practical value. Practical value here is all about helping. This is why people share in the first place. People like to help others. So one, need to highlight the incredible value. We talked about the psychology of deals. Highlight the incredible value. Two, observe the rule of 100 when you're talking about money type deals. Three, package knowledge and expertise so that people learn while they pass it along. And four, make it clear why the product or idea is so useful that people just have to spread the word. Those are the four. Those are the four things to take advantage of practical value.
That's the hot sauce.
That's the hottest of sauces. Yeah. Let's move on to stories. Let's move on to stories here, Marshall.
Okay. So stories, as a recap, they don't just share information. They tell stories. Just like the Trojan horse, stories are vessels that carry things such as morals and lessons. Information travels under the guise of what it might seem like idle chatter. So we need to build our own Trojan horse, embedding our products and ideas in stories that people want to tell. I'm going to say this. The narrative, when you're speaking in narrative, it is much easier to pass along, as in the game of telephone. Okay. It might not be easy to remember specific product information, but when it's embedded into a story, okay, the parts of the story that connect to whatever message or moral or whatever it is that you're trying to communicate become attached to it. It's like they cling to each other, and now they're woven in into this fabric of a narrative, and it travels a lot better, and it's more compelling because people get engrossed into the story. We talked about this in the Pitch Anything part of the book, is you got to create this narrative, this level of intrigue, so that people stay in tune with what you're talking about.
The whole story of the Trojan horse, for all of you history buffs out there. You a history buff, Marshall?
I'm not a history buff.
Sam, you a history buff? Sam, sort of a history buff. For the Sams out there. The Trojan horse story was just like anything back in the day. It was an oral tradition. Nobody wrote stuff down. It was just something, you stood around the campfire, you huddled around the campfire, people told stories. That's like what they did for entertainment. And this is one of the stories that got passed on from generation to generation for hundreds of years before anybody wrote anything down. Okay? Then come along some people that decide to write it down. The actual story was hundreds of lines of poetry filled with personal vendettas, adultery, double crosses, the whole thing. And why was it told and written this way? Because, just like Marshall was saying, people don't think in terms of information, they think in terms of narratives. Narratives are inherently more engrossing than basic facts. So the story got passed down from generation to generation because it was such an interesting narrative. The story around it was so interesting. There's so much intrigue to it. There wasn't like, let's gather around the, I got to gather around the campfire. I've got a story to tell you. So these guys, they built this giant horse and they hid in it, and then they killed everybody when they woke up later. You're like, what?
That was basically the Trojan horse story.
Marshall, go ahead and give them the Trojan horse story. I realized you don't know the Trojan horse story?
I mean, I don't know it in great detail.
I'll give you the Trojan horse story in case I wildly, inaccurately assumed that
everybody knows it.
Well, I was talking to Sam. Sam's a history buff. He knows what it's about. The Trojan horse story, this is how well I know the story. It was the Greeks and the, was it the not the Romans, the like,
dude,
Trojans?
Dude, that's why I just deferred. I was not even going to.
The Greeks and some other people, they were fighting for a long time.
I'm pulling it up.
Pull it up. They were fighting for a long time. Couldn't get past the castle walls, right? Couldn't do it. Couldn't get past it. Fought forever. back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Nothing. Nothing was happening. So the Greeks, they do this thing. They build this giant horse. This horse-looking figurine. They wheel it up to the gates, and then they sail away. They go out to the shore, they get in their ships, sail off into the night. Do we know who the other people are yet?
Troy,
that's right. Yeah, the Trojans, yeah. I knew they weren't actually called Trojans. Yeah, the city of Troy. Okay, so the people of the city of Troy were like, yes, it's over, they gave up. We fought them off. Let's celebrate. We're going to wheel this big old thing inside the castle gates. This big trophy of ours that we got, this big horse, this is going to be the symbol of our victory. Let's party. So they partied. Stayed up all night, singing, dancing, drinking, whatever else they do back in the Troy days. And then after everyone's gone to sleep, the Greeks just sail back. They had sailed out during the day because, you know, there's no, like, sophisticated tracking systems at this point. Someone from Troy said, they sailed away.
There's no UAVs. There's no radar.
They just sailed back during the night. And they had hidden some of their soldiers inside of this horse.
And they couldn't see them sailing back
because it was night. Because it was night. They had no lights. They had no electricity. They didn't know. So then the Greek soldiers are hidden inside of this Trojan horse. Get up out of the horse. They go open up the castle gates. They let in all the Greek soldiers. And the war's over and Greece won. So that's the Trojan horse stories. Trojan horse story.
You tell it so well.
Well, I only told like the short version of it, but that's kind of it. Now, why did this catch on? Why was this a story that was told over and over and over? Well, there was like a moral to the story, right? Like a point of the story. But also it was just a good story. It was a narrative. It was like an interesting story. So people pass this on from generation to generation. Narratives are inherently more engrossing than basic facts. Remember social currency? We talked about that in a previous episode.
Yeah.
Stories are used to communicate social currency. I use my stories to tell you why I have this bit of currency, this bit of, oh, I'm pretty cool because I know about this thing. Did you hear about this thing I did? Did you hear about the thing on the TV, the thing? The display of practical value are driven. I'm communicating social currency. They're driven by high arousal, emotion. There's some sort of emotion to them, right? Talked about that in a previous episode. But there's information always lurking in the narrative. So, Marshall, let's talk about how people learn. We're going to talk about how people learn, Marshall. You ready to talk about
that? I am so ready.
Go ahead and give us the scenario here. The scenario here is you're in a town, haven't had your car worked on yet. All of a sudden, something goes wrong with your car. You need a good mechanic that won't overcharge you. That won't, you know, won't screw you. Won't say, oh, there's this wrong, and I also had to fix the R-valve. Your R-valve was clogged.
I hate that.
And I'm like, I don't know anything about cars. I sure hope my R-valve is okay. Right? So you're looking for a good mechanic that won't overcharge. Marshall, talk to us about the different ways that we could possibly learn about this mechanic. The mechanic that we are looking for, how can we find him?
Okay, you got a couple options. One, you can just do trial and error. So the local mechanic, the closest guy, you just go to him and you're like, oh, I'm hoping for the best. Trial and error.
Trial and error. I'm just going to try somebody and see what happens.
Yeah.
What are the downsides of trial and error?
It's costly and time consuming.
And it might not work.
And it might not work.
You might be looking for the guy who won't overcharge you and you find the guy that will overcharge you. Okay, yeah. So trial and error. A little scary.
Second is direct observation. Okay. So you basically say, hey, over the next 4 days, every day I'm going to shadow a different mechanic. Okay, I like the way that he takes off that lug nut.
I like the cut of his jib.
That's right. Cut of his jib. And basically observe all of the different interactions with these mechanics. So direct observation, that's another option. It's very time consuming.
What's the problem with this move, direct observation? What's the problem with it?
It takes so much time.
And also, what mechanic is going to be like, yeah, totally, just follow me around all day long and inspect my every move?
Yeah, I don't know.
Wouldn't that be weird?
Yeah, I don't know.
It seems like that might be a little bit weird. And you're going to spend an entire week trying to find out if this mechanic is going to get you or not. And as soon as you find out he will get you, you're going to have to move on to the next mechanic and do that again. Okay, what's another way we could possibly learn about who this mechanic is?
Checking out different ads.
Okay, there's ads, sure.
Okay.
What's the problem with advertisements?
I mean, the job of ads is to get you to come to the place of business.
They're just trying to sell you something.
Yeah, so it's like they're trying to make it look as attractive as possible.
Do you understand this when you're watching an ad?
Yes.
Sam, when you're watching an ad, do you know that people are trying to sell you something?
Good ads, you don't. But I would say most ads, you're like, oh, they're trying to get me to buy something.
Does that make it feel a little bit less like...
genuine.
A little less genuine, a little less like, oh, these guys are definitely on the up and up.
That's right.
Okay. So people are generally skeptical of persuasion attempts. So what's another way we could do it?
Stories.
Oh, stories. Tell me about the story.
So one good story about a mechanic who fixed the problem without charging is worth dozens of observations and years of trial and error. So if you were looking for a mechanic and I was like, hey, there's this guy. He did a great job with my fender. Okay. He'll do a great job with your R valve. And that story is a great story.
And I'm like, oh, this guy that Marshall uses, I'm leaning on credibility. We talked about social proof in previous episodes. I'm leaning on the credibility of knowing Marshall, knowing that Marshall's not going to try to get somebody to overcharge me because it doesn't benefit Marshall to do so. And he says, I worked with this guy. I worked with Bill. And Bill did me right. Didn't overcharge me. Got the work done on time. I'm happy with Bill. I will go back to Bill if I need to go back to Bill. And then I'm like, well, if he's good enough for Marshall, then Bill, here I come with my R-valve problem.
That's right.
And it didn't take me trial and error and direct observation. And maybe I saw an ad for Bill, but I now at least believe the ad for Bill. So that's why stories solve this problem. That's why good stories solve this problem. Let's talk about some good stories and let's talk about some bad stories here, Marshall. Mm. Tell me about a good story. Tell me about a good story and a franchise Subway shop.
Good story. A little ways back, Subway employed the use of the Jared Fogel story.
You may have heard of him.
Okay. Jared Fogel, he lost 425 pounds eating at Subway. Mr. Fogel started appearing in its ads. Subway sales have more than doubled to $8.2 billion.
So homie is largely overweight. Large. Like if you lose 425 pounds and you still have some left over, you are a large dude.
Very large dude.
He decides he's going to finally get in shape, and he does so by only eating at Subway. Mm. And he loses a ton of weight. Do other people want to be healthy and lose weight, Marshall?
I would say most people do.
So people see that, and they're like, holy crap, do you see how much weight he lost eating at Subway? If I eat at Subway, I will probably be healthier. I will probably lose weight. And their sales doubled to $8.2 billion.
Doubled.
Billion.
With a B.
Communicate a simple narrative. Eating at Subway is healthy, and you can lose weight doing it if you eat Subway all the time. So then people were like, I'm eating Subway all the time now. That's my move. Now, just don't Google the end of that story. Just don't Google how it ended up for Jared Fogel. We're going to keep the good story part of how Subway used the story and not the ending sad story. Okay, we'll move past that part. Another good story. Dove Soap. Dove Soap.
Are you talking about soap or am I talking about soap?
You talk about soap.
Okay. So Dove had a natural beauty campaign going on. One of the things they did was address the fact that only 2% of women counted themselves as beautiful, in large part based on what the media magazines views are as pretty. They showed all the specific things that went into making a pretty normal girl into a model. All the makeup, the enhanced photo session, grabbing a few, select few from the session, then photoshopping her appearance in the right places to end up with a model. Okay. Something that didn't look like the natural girl. Since many women felt the same way about themselves, this struck a chord with them, prompting a lot of controversy about what it meant to actually be beautiful. Dove got hundreds of millions of dollars of exposure, won numerous industry awards, more than tripled the website traffic the company received from their Super Bowl ad, and Dove experienced double-digit sales growth.
So Dove has this video they make. Their whole deal, Dove is identified that the people that buy soap are women. Which is probably true. More times than not, I would guess. Well, what is one thing that that all these women, all their target customers, have struggled with? Well, they struggle with how they're viewed as attractive or not, beautiful or not. And they look at all the magazines, they look at all the models, and they're like, well, if that's attractive, that's not me, therefore I am not attractive. And Dove says, well, check this out. You are attractive because look what goes into making these people a model. And shows all the process and all the, like, it's like almost a day-long worth of stuff, like hours of makeup, hours of photo set of shoots, taking like the select few from that photo session shoot, and then photoshopping it to where it doesn't even look like the normal person anymore. And they're like, okay, that's pretty. And it struck a chord with them because then they're like, hey, if that's what's going on, then maybe I really am pretty. Got this whole controversy, this whole thing going on about how the media and magazines and stuff, like how they say what pretty is compared to like what normal people look like.
Mm.
Tripled their website traffic, like compared to their Super Bowl ad. They put on a Super Bowl ad, probably spent $4 million on the Super Bowl ad to make sure that everybody saw it. This tripled that traffic. They experienced double-digit sales growth.
That's the hot sauce.
They communicated a story that resonated with their target audience.
That's the hot sauce.
Let's talk about a bad story here, Marshall. Bad as in didn't work. I'll set the context for you.
Okay.
Context. Olympics. We're at the Olympics. The man from Canada gets up to the high dive, takes off his warm-up pants. He's up on the high dive. Leaps from the high dive. I think it's only 3 meters. I don't know. I mean, it's not a high dive necessarily, but leaps from the diving board. Complete belly flop. Marshall, give us the rest of the story here.
I think was he a competitor? Was he an Olympian? Or was
he
it
was
a
not.
Dude? Yeah, he crashed it. He ran out onto the pool deck and yes. ran up the high dive.
Yes, he was not a competitor. He was from Canada. He did jump into the athletes area,
yeah.
then ran up the diving board.
Yeah.
And what's the rest of the story?
He was streaking. He's wearing a tutu, and on himself, he had painted goldenpalace.com.
Goldenpalace.com.
Yep.
And he's wearing a tutu.
And it got a ton of attention.
Oh, yeah. It's the Olympics. You probably would talk about that.
And everybody's talking about the story. But the fact that the sponsored goldenpalace.com wasn't an integral part to that story, nobody knew about it.
People quit talking about goldenpalace.com.
They didn't even know. First of all, if they're showing the clip, they're blurring out him. So you're probably not seeing it. And second of all, it's not an integral part to the story.
So because it wasn't a big part of the story and it had nothing to do with casinos,
yeah,
it didn't do anything for goldenpalace.com.
That's right.
It was the fool in the pool is what the video was titled. Received tons and tons and tons of attention, but in no way did that generate anything for goldenpalace.com because goldenpalace.com had nothing to do with a Canadian guy in a tutu jumping off a diving board at the Olympics.
That's right.
So people talked about the stunt but left out the casino because that part was irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the guy got arrested.
Yeah, felony charge.
As you might suggest, as you might have guessed. One more good story here, Marshall. Read us one more good one to close us off.
Blendtex Will It Blend campaign. It's impossible to tell the story of the clips where the blender tears through an iPhone without talking about the blender itself.
Have you seen these Will It Blend?
Yeah, it's amazing.
What else do they blend through?
Like a mop?
A mop? Okay. Okay, what else?
A desktop computer.
Okay, so these guys are saying, which the whole story behind the Will It Blend campaign is pretty funny, but they're saying, we got a blender. And start putting on videos on YouTube and say, will it blend? And just start throwing crazy stuff in there and see if our blender can handle it.
Yeah.
And so they buy like a brand new $700 iPhone, something that people are standing in line for, can't get to, standing in line for, And they're like, will it blend? And just tossing it in there to see what happens.
And it does. It does blend.
And it's a great story because it's something like, you've got to see this. This guy just blends up an iPhone. It's crazy.
And it's about the blender, so.
So it's impossible to tell the story without talking about the blender.
That's right.
As you might guess, BlendTech did very well with that campaign.
Very, very well.
So how to craft a good story. How to craft a good story. The summary here. One, try to build your own Trojan horse, something that sneaks past the gates of the advertisement wall that your customers might have up against, like saying, nope, it's an advertisement. You got to get a Trojan horse to get past that wall. Think about valuable virality. How does this going viral help our brand? Number two, make sure the information you want people to remember and transmit is critical to the narrative. So what's the point of what's going on? Does it matter to you? Like, if you're saying, we're going to get a ton of exposure. I'm going to have a guy jump off a diving board in a tutu, and he's going to have his, you know, painted on his chest, goldenpalace.com. It probably won't work. That part of the story will get left out. If people don't connect the content back to you, it's not going to help you very much. Number three, the ultimate goal is to build a, and this is where we start putting in a bunch of these triggers all here, Marshall. The ultimate goal is to build a social currency-laden, triggered, emotional, public, and practically valuable Trojan horse that has your message hidden inside. That's what Dove did. And number four, make sure your desired information is so embedded into the plot that people can't tell the story without it. They can't leave you out of the story.
That's important.
If you go to the trouble of making something that people do actually want to share, you want to make sure that you get to go along for the ride.
That's true.
We made this awesome video and hit 10 million hits, but we did not sell anything.
Does not connect.
I forgot to put the website on the video.
It's amazing.
So that's how to craft a good story. So, Marshall, in recap, the six principles of contagiousness. Go ahead and read the six. I'll read them. You are not emotionally prepared to read them. I am emotionally prepared to read them.
I was already emotionally preparing for the daily wins of the week.
The last recap, six principles of contagiousness. If you've not seen all six of these, you've not heard all six of these, make sure you watch previous episodes 44 and 45. They are social currency, triggers, emotion, public, practical value, and stories, and that is how you get things to catch on. That's how you make word of mouth contagious. You can also read that book, Contagious,
yeah,
by Jonah Berger.
I love that book.
It's a great book.
It's orange.
It is orange. It'll help. This is the Bo Outlaw episode, the King of the Summer League episode. Marshall, what are the daily... You have a daily win of the week?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. I need you to announce the daily wins of the week. Like, you are a Summer League announcer that's trying to make it to the big time. You're like, it's the Summer League. It's just like rookies and guys that like aren't superstars, right? And you're like, this is my shot. This is my shot. I'm going to make it to the big time.
And ladies and gentlemen, standing. Actually, I feel like the ladies and gentlemen, it fit
this
well
part there. Actually fits. This might be the first one where that actually fits.
Ladies and gentlemen, standing at 6'8", he is 265 pounds. Mr. Bo Outlaw, wearing number 46, the King of the Summer League. You got Bo Outlaw over to the left. He passed the ball. He drives down to the baseline, passes over to Dan McKenna. Dan McKenna fakes the shot, doesn't shoot. And then he passes over back to Bo Outlaw, who gets fouled. Bo Outlaw to the line. Will he make the shot? He's shooting currently a 48% for the Summer League season. Better chance that he doesn't make it than he actually does make it, but we're hopeful. Ladies and gentlemen, the first shot is up. It is good.
Oh, wow.
It's like a miracle. And the second shot, it goes up, and it's also good.
Wow, beating the odds, Bo.
And if things could not get better, ladies and gentlemen, now we got the daily wins of the week.
That's pretty good. I like that. A lot of your normal announcing type stuff totally makes sense in that scenario.
Whatever.
Okay, what's the daily win here?
Daily win of the week. this past weekend, we just had 65 people here in the building for our weekend workshop. It was awesome. Clay Clark, the U.S. Small Business Administration Entrepreneur of the Year, and myself, we were speaking to the group. We were taking them through the 13-step proven path to success that we teach here at the weekend workshop. It's a two-day workshop, 16 hours of intensive business training, and a ton of people left. They said that this is incredible. This is like better than any Tony Robbins seminar. This is better than any other like big business conference that they've been to, because we get into the specifics of how to grow a business. And so it was just really, really cool. We were rocking out to some Justin Timberlake up here in the office. We had some pinion wood burning.
Oh, wow.
It was really cool to be able to connect with all those people from really all over the country. We had California. We had Texas. We had Boston. It was a good deal.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
All over the nation.
That's right.
Came on into the workshop this last weekend.
That's right.
It was a full house. It was great.
It was a full house. So, hey, if you want to learn about the weekend workshops, you go up here to thrivetimeshow.com/workshops. You can get the full itinerary of what we cover during the workshops. You'll love it. It's 2 days, a ton of business coaching. If you want one-on-one business coaching, you can learn more about that on that page, or you go to thrive15.com. You sign up for a business evaluation. Dan, you know what?
What?
If they go and they have a business evaluation, they can get a free digital copy of Clay's book, Thrive, Move Beyond Surviving Now.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. Take control of your destiny and move beyond surviving now. They can get a free digital copy of that if they mention they heard it on the Daily Hustle.
Oh, wow. That seems like a deal.
It's a deal.
That seems like something that's contagious. That could pass. I mean, that's practical value.
And
that's some social currency right there.
And if I am doing the 13-point evaluation, you recommend to do the evaluation with me personally, I'll give you Dan's personal cell number.
Wow. Look at that. That's a great deal.
That's a great deal.
They were not expecting that, so their expectations were here, and now we just went up here with them.
That's right. Okay. if you just want to do the whole online video training portion of thrive15.com, you can get on there. You can try it for $1, thrive15.com. You try it. Your first month's $1. It's a no-brainer. You just get on there, and you just do it. Dollar well spent.
A dollar. And we've had people that are changing their businesses and therefore their lives because of this.
That's right.
Real deal.
Hot sizzle.
It's awesome.
Boom.
Again, that's thrive15.com or on the workshops at thrivetimeshow.com/workshops. This has been episode 46, also part 3 of Making Word of Mouth Contagious. We are excited to see you again next time. Over there, Marshall F. Morris. Over here, Daniel McKenna. That is it for the Daily Hustle. Boom.